Chapter 38, Athens and the Peloponnese. Athens was both extremely crowded and extremely hot, and instead of its ancient violet crown, it wore a dun-coloured mantle of modern industrial smog. Terry and I arrived in the city shortly before midday. We had spent the night at a spot a few miles on from Labadia, which was once the seat of the oracle of Trophinius, and having crossed the Boeotian plain with its newly harvested wheat fields, had made our way over range upon range of low mountains to emerge eventually into the plain of Attica, where we were at once surrounded by the silver green of the olive, Pallas Athene's gift to the people of Athens. Soon we were driving past Eleusis, and as we approached the coast, could see not only a skyline disfigured by tall factory chimneys, but also, through the haze, the vision of a white rock on which stood a pure white temple, the Acropolis, and crowning it, the Parthenon. Parking proved to be a matter of some difficulty, but after driving around for a while, and incidentally enjoying a view of the Parthenon from the west, we managed to find a spot. According to my diary, we found it near Onomia, by which I must have meant Omonia, or Concord Square, for my diary further records that we explored the area a little on foot and ate some rather sickly Greek sweetmeats. We also looked in at some of the bigger souvenir shops, but to our disappointment, the reproduction pottery was inferior in quality to what we had seen in Delphi. At 3 o'clock, we decided to find a campsite. Unfortunately, we took the wrong road out of Athens and found ourselves down at the harbour of the Piraeus, so that, having re-entered the city and found the right road, it was 4 o'clock before we booked in at Athens Camping, as the site was called. Here we spent the rest of the day, as we felt too tired to do more than make a few purchases at the camp shop and go for a little walk. In the same way that Delphi meant the temple and oracle of Apollo, so for me Athens meant the Parthenon, where the great chryselephantine statue of the Virgin Goddess had once dominated the inner sanctum. And the following morning, Terry and I lost no time driving into the city centre through the thick haze, the product less of car exhausts than of the countless smoking chimneys, and then round to the western slope of the Acropolis. Here we parked the little bus, and having climbed up to the Bull Gate and followed the zigzag ramp through the forest of ruined Doric and Ionic columns that was the Propylae, at last attained the summit of the Acropolis, 512 feet above the surrounding city. Before me, planted firmly on the highest point of the great limestone rock, with nothing behind it but the bluest of blue skies, there rose, dazzlingly white in the brilliant morning sunshine, the miracle that was the Parthenon. Though time, vandalism, and war had damaged the structure badly, there was nothing left of the roof or the walls of the cellar. Most of the 50 or more enormous fluted Doric columns were still standing or had been restored, and Terry and I wandered among them, admiring their beautiful proportions. Except for the Erechtheum, famous for the porch of the Caryatids, and the Sanctuary of Zeus, both of which we also explored, much of the area surrounding the Parthenon was a waste of white marble fragments from which the sunlight was reflected so dazzlingly as almost to hurt the eyes. Such sculptures and carvings as had survived, more or less intact, and were not in the Berlin Staatliche Museen, the British Museum, or the Louvre, were housed in the Acropolis Museum, which was situated in the southeast corner of the citadel, and into whose coolness and gloom we were glad to escape from the growing heat outside. Though the rooms contained much that was memorable, I recollect only the enigmatically smiling Norae, or maidens. A calf-bearer that could well have been the prototype of early Christian representations of Christ as the Good Shepherd, and a calmly beautiful bas-relief of Pallas Athene leaning on her spear. Before leaving the Acropolis, we stood and gazed down for a while at the urban sea, which, spreading in all directions, lapped against the tree-girt lower slopes of sharply pointed Mount Lycabettus, a mile or so away to the northeast. Beyond Lycabettus, on the horizon to the north, there extended the shadowy blue shapes of the mountains, where ancient Athens had obtained the marble from which the Parthenon was built. Sweating profusely in the intense heat, we walked back to the little bus, and from the little bus to the Pnyx, the hill on which the Athenian democracy met, and then to the ancient central agora, or marketplace, which were situated west and northwest, respectively, of the Acropolis. The agora was dominated by the Doric so-called Theseum, said to be the best-preserved Greek temple in the world, it having been used successively as a Christian and as a Muslim place of worship. Like the bigger and slightly later Parthenon, it was surrounded by a waste of white marble fragments, fragments that had once been part of the various administrative and religious buildings which then occupied the area. Near the Theseum stood an Orthodox church, but although we ventured inside, I remember nothing of what we saw. I do, however, recollect the little wayside chapels, in themselves miniature churches, that we saw here and there in the bustling modern city. Some were hardly bigger than a good-sized doll's house, but all were complete with the traditional round-arched doors and windows, triangular gables, and red-tiled domes. On our way back to the little bus, we decided to visit Cape Sunion, southernmost point of the Attic Peninsula. Why we decided to visit it, I cannot say. Perhaps we wanted to get away from people, by whom we seemed to be always surrounded, even on the steps of the Parthenon and in the Acropolis Museum. Perhaps we wanted to escape from the polluted atmosphere of 20th century Athens and breathe the ozone-laden air of the coast. Or perhaps, again, we simply wanted to see the famous Temple of Poseidon. Whatever the reason for our decision may have been, we left for Cape Sunion straight away, driving first down to the Piraeus via Omonia, and from there following the scenic coastal road south. We spent 3 days at the coast, camping one night near the fishing village of Lagonissa, and one night in the vicinity of the Cape. During the day we explored the little rocky bays and inlets, where pebbles of many beautiful hues could be picked up, wandered along the fine sandy beaches, washed clothes, brewed tea, and heated up can after can of minestrone. Terry spent a good deal of time swimming in the warm, sunlit coastal waters, the colour of which ranged from pale turquoise near the shoreline to cobalt blue further out. While he was thus disporting himself, I sat on a nearby rock reading, on different occasions, Plato's Apology of Socrates, Ion and Meno, and Euripides' Bacchae, all of which I had read before, but never in such propitious surroundings. One afternoon, we drove a few miles up the other side of the peninsula to a stretch of coast known, according to the guidebook, as the Green Coast. Why it was so called was a mystery, though the view over the Saronic Gulf was a sufficient recompense for the journey. There was not a scrap of vegetation to be seen. There was only naked rock and sun, and no shade, consequently, in which to park, so that we were obliged to turn round and drive on until we found, back on the eastern side of the peninsula, a line of what I took to be tamarisk trees. Tamarisks or not, they were certainly trees, and we were glad to take advantage of their scanty shade. The most rewarding part of our little excursion was the visit we paid to the Temple of Poseidon, god of the sea, or rather, which we paid to the 12 white Doric columns that were practically all that was left of the imposing 5th century BCE structure. The temple stood on a headland and commanded a fine view of the Motoan Sea, whose calm waters were dotted here and there with the dim shapes of islands. According to the guidebook, Lord Byron had written his name on one of the columns. We did not see the signature, but if the noble lord had indeed committed such an act of vandalism, he had set later visitors to the site a bad example. That evening, the evening of the day on which we paid our respects to the trident-wielding god of the sea, Terry admitted to feeling rather depressed, which indeed was obvious. Though the attack was not a serious one, it necessitated our having a long talk, and we were late getting to bed. In the morning, my poor friend was still feeling depressed, but as the day wore on, the dark cloud lifted, and by the time we returned to Athens in the late afternoon, he was quite cheerful. Fortunately, the cloud remained lifted, and except for the occasional minor relapse, he stayed cheerful for the remaining weeks of our tour. In Athens, we drove straight to the Acropolis, where Terry took photographs, and we watched the sunset, and from there to Athens camping. That night, we had a problem to discuss, a problem that might have caused us serious inconvenience and even disrupted our travel plans. On the way back to Athens, we had become aware that the little bus had developed engine trouble and was in danger, perhaps, of breaking down. What were we to do? We could not do anything that night, but early the following morning we drove, very gingerly, into Athens in search of information and advice. The Greek Automobile and Touring Club was not very helpful, but eventually, after we had walked around for 2 or 3 hours and cashed travellers' checks, posted cards and bought a new cylinder of gas, we succeeded in locating the Volkswagen Repair Centre. They would not be able to do anything until Monday, they told us. It was now Friday. But if we took the little bus in early on Monday morning, they would give the engine an overhaul, and with this we had to be content. Sunday was perforce a day of rest, for not wanting to risk having a breakdown on the way, we did not go anywhere. Instead, we spent the whole day at the campsite, where I read Plutarch and Aeschylus and started on the Pelican History of Greece. As we did not know what was wrong exactly with the little bus's engine, nor how much time it would take to put it right, Monday was a day of some uncertainty. It was also a day of disappointment, in one respect at least. Having left the little bus at the repair centre, we walked via Euripides Street and America Street, piquant juxtaposition, all the way to the National Archaeological Museum, our idea being to spend the rest of the morning in its galleries. We arrived there punctually, at the usual opening time, only to discover that it was closed on Mondays. Fortunately, the museum gardens were open, and still more fortunately, on our way through America Street, we had called in at the English bookshop and added to our stock of classical authors. Instead of spending the morning with the masterpieces of Greek sculpture, therefore, we spent it with Richard Latimore's The Odes of Pindar, Benjamin Rogers' translation of 5 comedies of Aristophanes, and the essential works of Stoicism. Though both he and I dipped into all 3 volumes, Terry, I think, spent more time with the philosophers and I with the poets. We had been told that the little bus might be ready for collection by 2 o'clock. Having had our fill of poets and philosophers, at least for the time being, at 11:30 we left the museum gardens and set out for the Volkswagen Repair Centre, stopping on the way only to buy some Greek sweetmeats and sit in one of the squares eating them. Though the little bus was not ready for collection by 2 o'clock, it was ready an hour or so later, and we were able to take delivery of it, knowing that its engine was now in perfect working order and that there was no danger of our travel plans being disrupted by an untimely breakdown. We therefore returned to Athens camping in high spirits not untouched by a feeling of relief. We were glad to have the little bus back with us. We were glad to have it back, not simply because it was our means of getting from place to place. It was also our home, at least for the duration of our tour, and if we were obliged to be without it for any length of time, as had been the case that day, we felt naked and exposed, rather like a tortoise without its shell. With his extreme sensitiveness to other people, and especially to crowds, Terry felt such exposure more than I did. He was also quite attached to his convenient, comfortable dormobile. In fact, he was quite fond of it, and in the course of our travels, I too became fond of the party-coloured vehicle, half red and half white. Tuesday was our last day in Athens. Having decided to leave for Corinth and the Peloponnese by midday, we spent the morning in the National Archaeological Museum, the doors of which now stood wide open, and which was full, unfortunately, of parties of noisy tourists being shepherded from room to room by vociferous guides come lecturers. Though the museum covered all the periods of ancient Greek civilization, pride of place appeared to belong to the Bronze Age treasure from Mycenae. The treasure itself was not of bronze, but of gold, which probably accounted for the fact that the room in which it was displayed was the most crowded part of the museum, the majority of visitors, no doubt, being drawn to the artefacts less on account of their artistic refinement, which was of a high order, than because they were made of gold. Such was the crush that Terry and I caught only a glimpse of the gold masks that had covered the face of the dead, the gold bracelets and earrings, and the gold cups. We had a better view of the various kuroi, once known as archaic Apollos, as well as of the famous bronze statue of Poseidon on the point of hurling his trident, the graceful Praxitelean bronze boy, his eyes inset, I seem to remember, with white stone and coloured glass. And above all, though only a Roman copy, the marvellously poised Discobolus, or discus thrower. Whether gods or mortal men, they were all represented nude, as were other male figures in the museum's collection, whereas the female figures were usually draped. And the more I contemplated them, the more I was inclined to think, with Goethe, Schopenhauer and others, that the male human form was the more beautiful than the female. Hardly less impressive than the statues, in their own way, were the funeral stelae, with their reliefs of an old man and his hunter's son, a girl taking incense from a small box, and other scenes of a tender domestic nature. There was also the famous bas-relief from Eleusis, depicting the youthful Triptolemus between Demeter and her daughter Persephone. Demeter, the goddess of agriculture, was shown giving Triptolemus the first grain of corn. According to the myth, she also gave him a winged chariot harnessed with dragons, and bade him travel the world, spreading the benefits of agriculture among all men. It was in honour of Demeter and Persephone, together with Dionysus, the god of wine, that the Eleusinian Mysteries, the most famous mysteries of antiquity, were celebrated. They were celebrated in the Telesterion, or Hall of Initiation, at Eleusis, 15 miles from Athens, and it was in Eleusis that Terry and I found ourselves half an hour after leaving the National Archaeological Museum. A small independent city-state before it came into the Athenian sphere of influence in the 6th century BCE, it was now an industrial town. Writing in the year of our own visit, one traveller described it as singularly unattractive. Not only had the Goths and time wrought their usual destruction, but the foundations of the great hall and the scattered blocks of marble were surrounded by the smoking chimneys of several factories, so that he found it hard to imagine how such a scene of desolation could once have inspired the master of irreverence, Aristophanes, who wrote, "To us alone, initiated men, who act aright by stranger and by friend, the sun shines out to light us after death." This sun was the light which blazed forth when, at the supreme moment of the initiation, the doors of the Anaktoron, or King's House, which stood within the Hall of Initiation, were suddenly opened to reveal the hiera, or sacred objects. On the far side of the archaeological area there was a museum. Much of the statuary in it was Roman, but it also contained small-scale models of the temples and other structures that had occupied these sacred precincts. And these gave us, between them, a good idea of how ancient Eleusis must have looked. But no models, however accurate, could revive the atmosphere of the place, though tens of thousands, perhaps millions of people had received the deepest spiritual experience of their lives. No trace of that atmosphere remained. Unlike Delphi, the Eleusis of the Mysteries was spiritually dead, and it was therefore with thoughts not untouched by sadness that Terry and I left the once sacred site on the next stage of the day's journey. Corinth was situated at the foot of the isthmus connecting the Peloponnese with mainland Greece. Having joined the Italian-style motorway and driven southwest along the coast, we reached it in the middle of the afternoon. Or rather, we reached them, for there were two Corinths, the old and the new. Our business was with Old Corinth, a quiet, pleasant little town, hardly bigger than a village, but not so small as not to have several souvenir shops, in which we looked before visiting the archaeological area and the museum that stood on its outskirts. The archaeological area was a waste of ancient ruins, from the midst of which there arose, relatively intact, the seven squat, monolithic Doric columns that were all that remained of the 6th century BCE Temple of Apollo, while in the museum there was little of interest except the Roman mosaics. We then drove to the Acrocorinths, the great rock on the south which towered to a height of some 1,800 feet above Old Corinth, commanding as it did the approaches to the Peloponnese. The citadel had been fought over not only by Greeks and Romans, but also in more recent times by Franks, Venetians, Byzantines and Turks, all of whom had occupied it for a while, and all of whom had left their mark on the place. Terry and I did not climb to the top, but we climbed as far as the third gate, which was flanked by high towers, and from which there was a fine view of the surrounding countryside. We spent 5 days in the Peloponnese, visiting Mycenae, Tiryns, Nauplia, Epidaurus and Argos in the east, Sparta in the south, and Olympia in the west, all of them names no less redolent of myth, legend and history than were Dodona, Delphi and Athens. My companion and I had not been long on the road out of Corinth, heading for Mycenae, before we noticed that there was more vegetation here than in the Attica region. A good deal of tobacco was being grown, and there were olive gardens and vineyards, as well as plenty of wild thyme, the agreeably pungent scent of which filled the air. It was beside a field of tobacco, with the scent of thyme in our nostrils, that we slept that night, and before we left in the morning, I picked some of the aromatic herb. Though I had already bought an Achilles pottery plate and was to buy a small handmade rug, the real memento of my visit to Greece was those sprigs of wild thyme, which I kept in a small pot on my desk for many years, and whose fragrance served to remind me not just of the days I had spent in the Peloponnese with Terry, but of our whole Greek experience. On arriving at Mycenae, we were dismayed to find several coachloads of tourists already there and streaming up to the citadel. Following in their wake, we soon found ourselves standing in front of the famous Lion Gate and gazing up at the massive lintel on the triangular bas-relief above. This relief depicted two lions confronted, resting their four legs on the edge of a low, altar-like structure, on which there was a pillar which stood between them. Within the gate, surrounded by a double circle of stone slabs, were the shafts of the royal tombs in which Heinrich Schliemann, in 1876, had discovered the Bronze Age gold treasure that was now in Athens. Here we sat for a while consulting our guidebooks before ascending the broad, graded road that led to the summit of the Acropolis, and so to the terraces on which had once stood the palace of Agamemnon, the palace to which he had returned in triumph from the sack of Troy only to be murdered by his adulterous wife Clytemnestra. Ruins lay all around. Ruins not only of the palace and of the Doric temple, which, more than 1,000 years later, was superimposed on its remains, but also of the many houses that had surrounded the royal residence in its days of glory. From the Acropolis there was a view southward over the fertile Argolis plain. Back at the circle of stone slabs we sat down and tried to read, but the chattering tour groups and loud-voiced lecturers in French, German and English made it impossible for us to do this, and we therefore took refuge in one of the less important of the beehive tombs outside the Lion Gate. Here I read the Agamemnon of Aeschylus, the action of which takes place in the very palace whose ruins we had just been visiting. This was the first Greek play I ever read, and its grandeur inspired me, in my 14th or 15th year, with a wholehearted admiration for the genius of the great Attic tragedians, and for Aeschylus in particular, that I was never to lose. On my finishing the work, we visited the tomb of Clytemnestra and Aegisthus' tomb, as the two beehive structures had been known since the time of their discovery, though the period to which they belonged was not that of the adulterous queen and her paramour, but a much earlier one, that of the 16th century BCE. The biggest of the beehive tombs was the so-called Treasury of Atreus, also known as the Tomb of Agamemnon. According to the guidebooks, this was a very grand affair and well worth a visit, but so great was the number of people trying to get in that we decided to give it a miss and press on to Epidaurus. Between Mycenae and Epidaurus lay Argos and Tiryns, the former being, it was said, the oldest continuously inhabited town in Europe. It was a pleasant little place and apparently flourishing, even if not to the extent that it had flourished during the spacious days of the Heroic Age. We halted there only long enough to buy provisions, telling ourselves that we would see the archaeological area and museum on our way from Epidaurus to Tripoli, which for reasons I no longer recollect we failed to do. Tiryns was remarkable for its massive cyclopean walls, so called from the Cyclopes, the race of one-eyed giants, who the ancient Greeks believed had built the city for the legendary king Proetus. Some of the blocks used in its construction were 17 feet long and 7 feet high, and Hercules himself could hardly have moved them from their place. Tiryns had in fact a close connection with Hercules. It was to Tiryns that the Delphic oracle had sent the hero to serve for 12 years under King Eurystheus, in expiation for the crime of having killed his own children in a fit of madness. And it was Eurystheus who had imposed on Hercules his famous 12 labours. As in Mycenae, there was an Acropolis and the remains of a Bronze Age royal palace, both of which we saw. But so gloomy and oppressive was the place that we did not stay long in Tiryns. The very name of Tiryns, I thought, had a sinister sound, as if echoing down the corbelled stone galleries that ran within the thickness of the outer walls. Dodona, Delphi, and the Parthenon, to an extent, all had their distinctive atmospheres. Epidaurus, too, had its atmosphere, one that was immediately perceptible. It was a calm, healthy, harmonious atmosphere, as though a blessing rested upon the place. And it was not surprising that for 1,000 years, the sanctuary of Asclepius at Epidaurus should have been renowned as a centre of physical and mental healing. Terry and I arrived there towards evening, after a pleasant drive through low, pine-clad hills, and past orange orchards and lemon orchards, and whitewashed stone dwellings half hidden by olive trees. On our arrival, we parked at the edge of the archaeological area in a grove of pines. It was a pleasant spot, and when I had read the Chosphori, or Libation Bearers, the second part of the Great Trilogy, of which Agamemnon is the first, and we had eaten, the two of us set out for the ancient theatre, in which there had been accommodation for 17,000 spectators, and which Pausanias, the second century geographer, had described as the most beautiful theatre in Greece. A rehearsal of Euripides's The Trojan Women was in progress. The play was being performed, as we soon realised, not in the original language, or even in modern Greek, but in French. Nonetheless, with a sprinkling of other visitors, we sat and watched for a while, the semicircles of stone seating, rising tier upon tier behind us. The tragedies of Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides, and the comedies of Aristophanes, were regularly performed there during the summer months, we gathered, for though nothing remained of the stage buildings, the greater part of the auditorium had survived more or less intact and had needed little in the way of restoration. In the morning we looked around the museum, where a plaster model of the buildings that had formed the nucleus of the sanctuary enabled us to imagine what the place had been like in its heyday in the 4th century BCE. There was the temple of Asclepius, the god of healing, the much smaller temple of Artemis, the maiden goddess of the hunt and the wild, and the mysterious Tholos, with its two concentric circles of columns, an outer Doric circle and an inner Corinthian one. Most interesting of all, perhaps, was the abaton, or porch, where patients spent the night, and where they received, in their dreams, indications as to the kind of treatment they should be given by the establishment's priest-physicians. Such treatment must often have been effective. In the museum, there were stelae inscribed with descriptions of miraculous cures, as well as ex votos in the form of replicas of different limbs and organs, such as we had seen in the Basilica of St. Anthony in Padua. The beliefs and customs of pagan Greece had been inherited by Roman Catholic Italy. St. Anthony was the direct descendant of Asclepius. To me, Asclepius was the more attractive figure of the two. Indeed, he was one of the most attractive figures in the Greek pantheon. I do not recall seeing a statue of him in the little museum. The temple's famous Chryselephantine statue had long since disappeared. But his lineaments, as represented in ancient sculpture, were in any case familiar to me. He was represented standing, dressed in a long cloak, with bare breast and grasping a club-like staff, round which coiled a serpent. Himself the son of Apollo, he was sometimes accompanied by Telephorus, the boy genius of healing, and his daughters Hygieia, goddess of health, and Panacea. As Terry and I left the museum, as we wandered round the archaeological area, it was not difficult for me to imagine that the benign spirit of the divine physician still brooded over his ancient sanctuary.